The most astounding thing about the movie, and there are plenty of astounding things, was that for some reason, it didn't feel claustrophobic. And it all takes place on this big ship. Okay, the ship is not small. But, you know, after a while, you would assume that the walls would start closing in on you. But for some reason, it didn't feel that way.
Yeah, it's probably two people in a very large space that accommodates, obviously, thousands of people. But there the two of them are.
Yeah. Yeah. You had a little more time than usual working on this score.
I did. I started in June, kind of informally started in June. I'd seen, an early cut in early June, and it kind of excited me, and I wanted to get started. My formal work kind of began after July 4th, I remember, and finished up in November, so it was quite a long time.
Yeah, yeah, which in the film world is a long time.
Yeah, you work on Pixar movies for that kind of time period, but that's because they're rolling out sequences, and so I guess historically with Pixar, you'll work in three separate time periods over a period of 5 or 6 months.
Yeah.
But typically a movie is 12 weeks or something, 10 to 12 weeks, although I guess it varies more and more these days.
Yeah. Well, the score for Passengers earned the composer his 14th Oscar nomination, and during the next hour or so, we're going to be playing some music from Passengers and talking with the composer Thomas Newman about this fascinating film. Number one, welcome back to KUSC.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
And number two, congratulations again.
Oh, thank you.
It's always kind of a kick. I mean, you ask John Williams, who's gotten 50 nominations, and he says it's always.
Yeah, I was stunned, I must say. I mean, it's always great, but you never take this stuff for granted. You never think, oh, it'll happen. And I don't think I thought it would, and I was really surprised and pleased that it did.
And it's one of the scores that you're really very pleased with.
I am. I felt like I was in a good creative space through most of it. It was a tough movie because a lot was changing and CGI, you know, footages were changing because of computer graphics were coming in. But I felt creative. That's a good feeling to feel like when you start working, there's a place to go and a scent to follow.
Yeah, sure. Well, as we heard in the main title music, there are those very distinctive Thomas Newman sounds that are not necessarily made by cellos.
It's true. I mean, you know, the movie begins with this ship hurtling through space, and you're told that it's a 120-year journey, and there was just this feeling of endless turning of time or something, and so I wanted something to begin it that had a bit of a clock, a slow-moving clock, and then a bosun's whistle, a kind of processed bosun's whistle, to give some sense that you were just in the middle of nowhere, which I guess it's not a sense. It's, in fact, you are in the middle of nowhere. I mean, I think 30 years in or something on this 120-year journey.
Yeah, and they've all been put in, you know, cryogenic, whatever it is.
Hibernation pods, I think. Yeah.
Because, you know, 120 years, you know, take a chunk out of your life. And suddenly, for some unknown reason, well, because they go through a meteor shower and mm-hmm. the ship is seriously damaged, a guy wakes up.
That's right. And the idea is that the ship can handle this and that mostly it does, although on the bridge it registers that something is wrong or you get the sense that something is more wrong than usual. The premise, I think, is that these things do happen and the ship's ready for it. But in this case, it was a little too much and it wakes our hero.
Who's absolutely alone.
He's absolutely alone, and he remains alone for, I think, over a year, trying desperately to be a good person.
Yes, yes.
And because, do all the right things one can do as a...
Because he can't go back to sleep, meaning he's going to die in trouble.
That's right, and it takes, I think, 50 years for a message to travel to Earth and back. I mean, he's kind of screwed.
Yes. Called Wake for Seven, music from Passengers, the Oscar-nominated score by Thomas Newman. Maybe just a word about that cue.
Well, it's our first chance where we meet the character played by Jennifer Lawrence, and I think she's a little twitchy. She's been awake for 7 days. She has kind of no context of what time is, and she spends a lot of her time jogging and just trying to get out energy. So it has a twitchiness to it.
Yeah, and what she doesn't know, of course, that there's someone else awake, and he has actually awakened her after struggling over this.
Yeah, it's a big moral struggle, and perhaps the most interesting thing about the movie is a good man doing a not-so-good thing and then living with the consequences, you know, living with regret, but I guess also with the notion that he couldn't have done anything else. I at one point he tries to end his life and he can't do that. So the one thing that remains is to wake this girl that he sees inside this pod, who he's kind of fallen in love with just from afar. He's read all about her and seen her on computer screens, and he just can't help it.
Yeah. And I think one of the interesting things about the score, the extent to which it does not seem to be intentionally weightless, if you know what I mean.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, you know, it's a human story in the context of space, you know. And when I started, I think my predisposition was that there would be a lot of silence in the movie, as you associate with space or the oppression of space through an emptiness. But Morton Tilden, the director, really thought the music wanted to humanize the characters and wanted to turn, you know, there's comedy, there's irony in the story. So I think music was always going to do more than I think I originally thought.
Yeah. Yeah. Your first impressions of the picture in the form you saw it, it's very difficult to actually categorize this picture, which is the symptom of a good picture.
Right. Yeah. And you think it's a space movie and then it's not. It's kind of a love story and then it becomes an action movie towards the end. So it's surprising. It's tonally surprising. And I think along the way, in terms of music, you really wanted to make sure that you were sharpening the tone of the picture as it was taking place.
Now, did this director want specific things for the music to do, or is he one of those enlightened directors who just lets the composer do his job?
I think there was a bit of rope, but I think always with rope, there's going to be a moment of tightening the rope. So, I think with any creative collaboration, you want to try to encourage someone like me to do whatever he can, and then you see what you think. And then you have a context for what you think from that point on, and then you make adjustments and you sharpen, you know, the sensibility. I think that's essentially how it works with directors.
Yeah, yeah. Except in the old days when the only guy you had to please was the head of the music department, which was your dad. And if you could get it by Al Newman, you could get it by anything.
Right, but those were in the days where you really needed specific skills. You needed to know how to work with an orchestra. You needed to know how to conduct an orchestra. You needed that orchestra to change, you know, at 5 seconds. There was so much skill involved. I think now with technology, it's democratized anyone's ability to kind of rise up and have opinions that can then be implemented.
Looking at Jennifer Lawrence's face, which, you know, is a pleasure to do under any circumstances, but the way her face changed in the course of this movie, I don't want to say changed, but the incredible versatility of that face. I mean, it's kind of a thing like Catherine Deneuve. It's a stunningly beautiful face.
Yeah.
But it's got a lot of animation in it.
Yeah, very charismatic. I mean, there's just a lot of power to her that you just sense comes off the image.
Now, to what extent do those sorts of images sort of work their way into your compositional process?
If they do, it's probably intuitive, I think, unless, you know, a movie's pointing towards the beauty as opposed to just displaying it. So I just think you soak it all in. I mean, I think my best value to a director or to a movie is just to help people react, that it is a reactive experience. So how can the music I write help to illuminate a face or a bit of action?
You know, or explain things to the people who are making the movie, things that maybe they didn't quite see entirely.
I guess that's true. Just a sense of dimension, subtext. It's always a delight when you can bring a quality out of a movie that a director maybe thought was there but wasn't apparent, and that the music helps bring it out. Those are good moments.
Yeah. And of course, there are some directors, and I don't want to say they are the ones who are maybe not quite that certain about their craft, but they get to a point where they think that if music does something extra over and above what they intended visually, then they somehow haven't done their job.
Right. That could be pride and intention. And I try to get rid of intention. I think post-production is a great time to eschew intention and to say, here's what it is and how can we alter it if it could be made better. But you have to have a willing audience. And you're right. Sometimes directors want to hold fast to an idea as opposed to say, how can I alter it and make it better? So again, it's people skills. It's your ability to talk meaningfully to a director and see if you can make things, you know, better than they were without the music.
Yeah, there's a great deal of practical psychology involved in any sort of film role. But I think the composer, since you're invariably like the last important element that can change things one way or the other.
Right. And it, you know, you can't argue with taste. So if I play a piece that a director doesn't like, there's really going to be very little I have that can change his mind. And it could be just I don't like it very much, and write something else. I think I like that in a way. It's so obvious to me. It's a yes or a no. I mean, it can be less obvious and it can be maddening and vexing. But I think I like that game that I write and a director comments and decides, because I know my role is very clear to me. So I don't mind that.
Yeah. Yeah. And thank God it's kind of thing that, well, for instance, after Fritz Lowell and Oscar Hammerstein had died, someone got the bright idea to put together Richard Rodgers and Alan J. Lerner.
And on what show was it?
Well, that's the point. They began working, and Richard Rodgers wrote a tune for one of the lyrics that Alan J. Lerner had written. And Lerner said, "That's a charming tune, but I don't like it. Let's try something else." And no one had ever said that, apparently,
to Richard Rodgers.
Yeah. And that ended.
Yeah. I mean, pride can be a real bitter enemy in this process for that very reason. I think it's, for me, I'd much rather rewrite music than to argue why the music I wrote was right. Because, again, it's an argument you're going to lose. I mean, typically, you're going to lose that argument.
There you go. Called Chrysler Building. Didn't know they had a branch out in the...
There's a moment where Jennifer Lawrence's character mentions New York City and the Chrysler Building, and he overhears that. He's watching her on a computer monitor, and he kind of makes a crude model of it and leaves it for her. And it's kind of the beginning of the love affair in a way. It's an offering.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, throughout most of the movie, she doesn't know that he did it on purpose. And you're just kind of waiting for that foot to drop.
Right. It's a movie where the audience is, for the most part, way ahead of the characters, or certainly the Jennifer Lawrence character. And yeah, it's a certain amount of dread because you just know it. There's going to be this moment where just when things are getting better, they just fall apart, just like life, you know.
Yeah, and for much of the time, it's essentially a two-character movie. With the help of one living guy who gets reawakened
early. Right, as the ship begins to degrade more and more.
Yeah. And one of the great bartenders in the history of film, I think.
Yes, with no legs.
Yes. Well, they just get in the way, ultimately, in a bar. It's just an absolutely intriguing picture. I mean, I didn't know quite what to expect.
Yeah. It's a genre basher in a way, I guess, because you go in with a sense of it's a space movie and it ends up being, you know, not only a love story, but a story with a real moral dilemma that needs to be resolved.
Yeah, yeah. Plus, plenty of terrific action stuff.
Yeah.
Really tense on the edge of the seat stuff.
Yeah.
So I've always thought that science fiction as a genre, I mean, it changed completely with Star Wars. But, you know, Star Wars and all of the Star Wars that followed are essentially the same kind of thing. In that the basic tenet of science fiction is here's a reason to be optimistic because it's going to be centuries and centuries from now and we're still going to be here.
I mean, it's implied optimism.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's true with Passengers as well. You get the sense that Earth is thriving. There are issues with it, but you do see images of snowy landscapes. You get the feeling that Earth has done okay. That's sort of this built-in optimism.
Yeah. Do you like science fiction pictures as a rule, or does that not really figure into
it? I mean, I like science fiction. I'm drawn to it, I'm not sure I am. But, movies like Blade Runner, Star Wars certainly, they're fun movies. Alien, I mean, these are good movies.
Yeah. And this one, as you said, I mean, it doesn't quite fit the patterns.
Yeah. But again, it's one of those movies that starts and then veers, and hopefully you enjoy its veer because it defies your expectation.
Yeah, especially when the gravity goes out and she's in the swimming pool. I mean, it's just, as far as CGI effects go, it was a pretty spectacular one.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's definitely a good one. And then again, a sense of how do you literally become weightless. That was a challenge of scoring that scene, is how, you know, if water is rising up. What are you in the bottom end of the music, or if bottom end gives you excitement, does that give too much gravity, literal gravity to the scene when there's no gravity? That was a challenge.
Yeah. And what was your solution ultimately?
I probably decided to play it moment to moment because there's a moment when the water rises, there's a moment when she stops breathing, or when you know that she's going to have trouble. So I think I was playing action through most of that sequence. I think at the beginning, it's more style and a sense of what is it for water to lift out of a swimming pool. But then action, I think, took over.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Respighi and Wagner, you know, when they wanted kids playing, you know, in the Pines of Rome, there's no baseline at all. And of course, in the Valkyries, when they're flying around, no baseline at all.
Right. Yeah, I mean, because, you know, and bass is a real friend of movies. I mean, just because it just really packs a punch. It's more viscera than it is composition. So I think bass is always your friend as a film composer.
There you go. We talked about collaborating with directors, but you also do a lot of collaborating with the people who are actually playing your music in these scores. I think more than most.
Yeah, I do. I really appreciate the expressive input of musicians. And there's four or five that have been with me and worked with me forever and ever. Rick Cox, Steve Tavoloni, George Deering, Dan Greco, John Beasley. And I mean, typically I like to get together with some kind of spine, some kind of idea that has a dramatic flow to it. And I guess often is approved to some degree by a director, and just let players add things and try to see how it veers me off of my intent and how it excites my ears in a way I never would have expected. I mean, my theory is everyone is kind of expressively starved, so that if you ask players to be expressive and to offer up, I think it's a joy for them.
Especially when you got a pool of musicians in this town that are unlike anyone else in the world. I mean, I've said it so many times.
Yeah.
It's the greatest musicians on earth because they have no choice.
Yeah, and these guys, because we've worked together for so many years, there's a real shorthand. So there's and I think they know how to be brave, and I don't think I scare them, or that if they have an idea that I don't think they'll think, what would I think? They're willing to offer up ideas. I mean, I think that's what you want. I mean, I want to be kind of benevolent in my approach. I want to guide, but I don't want to strangle.
Excellent.
Because I think I get just more out. It works out better for me in the end if I do that.
At what point did you realize this score was maybe a little more special than, you know, some other special scores?
I don't think you ever know that. I think it's a jinx if you do. You just want to keep at it. You want to make it as good as you can at every moment, because here's your chance. Here's, you know, 2 or 3 minutes of blank space. I probably said this before, that is going to be filled in with ideas, and wouldn't it be great to listen back later and say, wow, that worked out. So I'm always just striving to enjoy the process as it hits my ears after I'm done.
Yeah, and some of the cues are also much longer than the typical music cue these days.
Right, and again, I think that's just the form and the shape of a movie. You know, some movies have short little burst transitions in music. Others, music is carrying dramatic weight, and then it's changing as the movie's changing, and it just is one of those things that you discover more as you work.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you keep doing it every time, obviously, because, you know, it just keeps getting...
I do love it. I just the opportunity to be expressive, I feel very grateful for.
Yeah. Thomas Newman just received his 14th Academy Award nomination for the score for Passengers. Tom, always a great pleasure.
Jim, thank you, man. It's great to be here.